Mike, let's look at a few more of the election returns. The fourth, let's see here, fourth Kentucky congressional district. This is Thomas Massie and Ed Gallrine. This shows 42% of the votes counted. Ed Gallrine is up 55.2% to 44.8.
Yeah.
And very, very close race there.
But look at the total number of votes, you know, for a congressional primary, mm-hmm. the percentage that is, but only 28,334 for Ed and 22,977 for Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is that, a little, you know, not quite 60,000 votes. That's kind of sad.
So think about this. Each congressional district has in the neighborhood of 750,000 residents there. They're not all voters, but residents.
Yeah.
And out of that, a small number are eligible to vote. A small number will vote in this primary.
Yes.
So if it's 20%, and I'm not sure the eligible voters, it's at probably half of that. It could be 300 and some thousand.
And depending on whether they're Republican or not, too. So.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So we will continue to watch that race and see what the outcome will be. In the Democratic primary in House District 14, you have, I'm sorry, State Senate District 14,
yes.
You have Kerry Gribbins Truitt, the Democratic candidate, with 1,146 votes to Malcolm W. Jones, 282 votes. Again, that's only 9%.
Right.
Of the votes that are counted there.
And that's become when Senator Higdon originally got that Senate seat, of course, we went into the House at the exact same time, but when he first got that Senate seat, it was still very heavily Democrat, but it has shifted. I don't know what the totals are, but it's very Republican now. So probably see a ton of Democrat votes.
Yeah. Mike, why is that? Let's talk about that for a moment and take a break as to why the shift in Kentucky. This is a question that comes up often. Why are people leaving the Democratic Party? Why are they going to the Republican Party? And it's all happened just in a few years, really dramatically. I think we became a majority registered Republican state.
Yes, it wasn't a few years. It took a few years when I started.
Yeah.
But no, when I first started, of course, you know, the area that I tried to win and lost the first two times when I won first Republican in 102 years, but it was only 25% registered Republican. And what I found was, you know, a handful of things. One, I knock on doors and people would open the door. I was like, what are you doing here? And it's like, I can't be seen with you. I'll lose my job. So part of it was, you know, people had to be Democrats to hold their job in those areas. But also I had people said my daddy was a Democrat and my daddy's daddy was a Democrat. And the other thing was, they said, you know, if you weren't registered Democrat, you couldn't vote in the primaries. And a lot of times the primaries determined who was going to be there, because the Republicans not only didn't have half the time did not have a candidate running, they definitely didn't have a primary. So if the Republicans did have somebody run, then the Democrats still felt comfortable to vote for who they wanted in the Democrat Party and then switch over and vote for the Republican. And it was just a slow one. Once you got close enough, there was the avalanche. But part of it, too, is the Democrats have also, or at least their platform, has changed over the years. I know after I lost those two races, I had somebody come up to me, a good friend, and he was like, man, you just need to change Democrats. You'd win everything we see. You'd win. And I was like, I can't. Because, you know, I don't necessarily agree with everything that Republicans stand for, but at that time, I agreed with the majority of them, and it was certainly a lot more than what the Democrat platform was. But, you know, I had some of my grandparents' friends who were Democrats, big Democrats. And I would say, you know, well, I'm pro-life. And she said, well, Democrats are too. And I was like, well, your platform doesn't say that.
That's right.
And would accuse me of lying. I mean, that they were nice, but, you know, they said a lot, but like that people don't plug in to what their platform actually says.
So it's not just the right to life issue. There are other big social issues, you know, gender ideology, boys on the girls sports teams. You had the rioting in 2020 where Democrats were viewed as the party against law enforcement. Now we've got Back the Blue efforts and Back the Blue rallies. I've seen the flags to support those in law enforcement. So you have some of those issues. Illegal immigration.
Right.
That's another issue where Democrats have supported it, or they're not serious about controlling the southern border.
Or in some cases, even our American flag was deemed by some Democrats as, you know, not being good, being harmful, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we take pride in it.
Colonialism or oppression.
Yeah.
And so these are the things that, as a party, when you take stands like that, that go against the grain of what much of rural America believes. You know, they believe in this country, the promise that it affords, supporting law enforcement, that there are two genders. And there's some, by the way, who say, well, these are junk food issues, that why do we focus on these things? But they're real issues. If you're a dad who has a daughter on the high school volleyball team and there's a young boy that wants to join the team or use the girls' locker room or restroom, then it's a real issue.
But as you said, we didn't start this fight.
Yeah. I've said that over and over. Yeah. There's some days, Mike, I'll be very transparent, but there's some days when I get weary of these things. I wish that we could talk about jobs and entrepreneurship.
Sure.
And more on public safety and these other
affordability things.
Absolutely. Housing and these other, you know, other economic issues. But the reality is that CPC didn't pick the fight. We did not create an unfettered access to abortion right. The federal Supreme Court did. The U.S. Supreme Court did in 73. We didn't redefine marriage. We didn't declare that gender is malleable and that boys should be able to, or girls for that matter, should be able to choose whatever gender they want. And then in the news today, there was a case in California where they're considered a transgender sanctuary state, a case where parents refused to affirm the gender identity of their minor child. That child was taken from the parents, and the state of California is putting that child up for adoption to another home. And Mike, I think of stories like this. It's heartbreaking. It's fundamentally wrong, and somebody has to speak out on it. And these issues, which were moral issues, political class has either put their stamp of approval on it, or they say, well, we shouldn't talk about it. No, these are real issues. It affects real lives, parental rights, the well-being of children, the health of children. These are foundational issues that we do expect our leaders to speak on. Why? Because that's where the battle is.
And the education of our children.
And these issues spill into the educational realm as well. Anyways, that's just a brief explainer as to why we engage.
When you get down, just remember, you and I have both read the good book. And we know how it ends.
We know how it ends, but also in the meantime, we've got to be vigilant.
We do have to be.
And we stand for what's right.
Yes.
And we do it in the right way. And we do it in a way that honors God. And there's a passage in Scripture, since you brought up the Bible, it says, rescue those being led away to death and to hold back those staggering towards slaughter. Yes. And I think the right to life issue comes to mind. But I think of young people, too, who are led away to deadly ideologies that say life doesn't matter, a nihilism, or gender doesn't matter. You can be whatever you want to be. That ends to a dead end in a really bad place. And we're told to warn those. We're told to rescue those. And this is something that the Christian community's done from Roman times. The very early church was there to meet needs of those around them. And this is where some people might say, well, Christianity sounds liberal. You're bringing in second and third class citizens, outcasts. You're letting them into your homes. You're feeding the homeless, clothing those who are naked. You are extending fellowship to the slaves. You're tending to those who are sick.
But you're doing it in the name of God. If it was liberal, they wouldn't want you to do it in the name of God.
Yeah. So this is something where, you know, as conservative Christians, we do see that compassion aspect.
Oh,
we do see that aspect where God would have us to be Jesus's hands and feet. We should care about the homeless.
Definitely.
We should care about those who are struggling in life, the single mom raising her kids, the broken family, the kid.
The widow, the orphan.
And it's deeply biblical to do that. Now, the difference, Mike, is a conservative Christian policy prescription compared to a left wing like a James Talrico, who's a very well-spoken, a very kind person running for U.S. Senate in Texas. He could win that race.
Potentially.
So, but here's the thing. We believe that individuals and churches and nonprofits are better suited to meeting needs of people in their community. When the federal government gets involved, however well-intentioned it might be, often the policies are ineffective, that they're inefficient. There's a lot of waste with that. But it takes out that human aspect. When the church engages and helps people, actually rolls up its sleeve, when people in the church roll up their sleeves to help the needy, it's a very different aspect because you're putting a heart in it. The government in a program doesn't have a heart. They can give a paycheck, but they can't offer compassion. They can put food on the table, but they can't feed somebody's soul. And look, we want people to have food. We want them to have a roof over their head. And I know I'm going a little bit downstream into some of the policy differences here, but I'm using this moment, I guess, to explain some of the differences between a conservative Christian view and maybe a far left Christian view. and the outcomes of those views. I think that we can say, though, that we should care as much as those on the left. And I think we acknowledge that those on the left care just as much about the poor and the outcast as mm-hmm. well. We just have a different way of meeting the needs there.
I agree.
All right. How are we doing on election returns?
Where all right. Let's see. Well, of course, you know, they had already called, as we said, for Andy Barr, for the Republican nominee for Senate. Does look like, well, it looks like Charles Booker has pulled ahead of Amy McGrath with about 25% of the vote in. Looks like Charles Booker's got 42, almost 40 on the vote. Of course, you know, Congressman Comer looks like he'll coast. He's got 87% of the vote with just 14.6. They haven't called that one yet, but I would imagine that one will be good. And then Brett Guthrie, he looks like he's got about 85% of the vote. And that particular one, just jumping down, right now it looks like Ed Gowron is still leading in the fourth. He's got 54% to Thomas Massey's 46% with about 62, almost 63% in.
If I could jump in, Mike, while you're looking at some of the results, yeah. It looks like Daniel Cameron is giving a concession speech right now. He's with his wife, Mackenzie, and he's talking about the race and thanking some of his supporters across the state. You know, it takes a lot to run for office, yes. Put yourself out there. It also takes a big man or woman that's running to graciously cede,
yes.
to acknowledge that they waged a good fight, but the voters have spoken, yeah. And to graciously, congratulate your opponent, and then to step aside.
Well, Daniel's very gracious, and Andy Barr will make candidate for the fall as well, depending on who runs against. But I guess any of the ones, the Democrats that are in the list, he should do well against. If it's Amy McGrath, I think he's already beat her once.
He has for Congress.
For Congress. And mm-hmm. then I don't know that Booker ever ran against him.
I believe he ran for the U.S. Senate.
Yes, yes.
And I think he ran in the Democratic primary for governor.
Yes.
Came up short there. That's when Beshear was on the ticket.
Yes.
So looking ahead, we're at the... Let's see here. Ryan Bivens is ahead of Steve Cavan in House District 24. Joe Redman in House District 27 is still over Rochelle Frazier.
Looks like 74. Looks like David Charles is got 65, almost 66% of the vote. So over Shannon Denniston and Aaron Williams.
Okay.
Yeah, it looks like Shannon got about 22% of the vote and Aaron about 12, a little over 12%. Of course, a little bit left to go. They haven't called it, but when you got 65% of the vote with 20% left, and that's probably going to be.
That was a race that I moderated, one of the state house races that I moderated, which was held by the Montgomery County Republican Party. Good event there. So, Mike, I'm looking at some of the other returns here.
Looks like Mark Hart in District 78. Looks like he will retain that seat, or at least make it through the primary on that seat. Had been a longtime legislator over there. He's been very kind to CPC as well over the years. Deanna Frazier Gordon, it looks like she will retain that House seat, or at least make it through the primary. She had stepped out to try to run for that 6th congressional district that Al Rodman
runs. Let's talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
So when Andy Barr stepped away from the congressional seat and announced he's running for U.S. Senate,
yes.
She jumped in, one of the early candidates.
Right. I think
Ryan Dotson was first. Then she jumped in, this colleague of Ryan Dotson's, and then eventually Ralph Alvarado. Right. And there's some other candidates as well, Plushinski. But she pulled away. Apparently, polling showed that she wasn't going to do very well. So she jumped back in to that House seat race. She said, I wasn't going to run. Well, I'm going to change her mind, and ended up filing. And that was a question of how would the voters perceive that?
Right.
Would they vote for her? And apparently tonight they're giving her at least the primary voters there are putting their confidence back in her. And what was the for the state Senate District 30 against incumbent Brandon Smith, who's been there, I want to say, since 14.
And it looks like Brandon is doing very well with about 51% of the vote in. He's got close to 57.8, and it looks like Bill Wesley has 42.2. But Brandon's been there for a long time. Brandon, actually, when I went into the House, he was in the House at that time. Mm-hmm. And he was actually, we were in the same row together. He was the one that reached over, and I was a brand new freshman in the House, hit my request to speak the button. And I was like, he said, no, when they call upon you, you know, introduce your guest. And I was like so nervous and everything. So they called upon me and I had like tons of family members there. So I introduced everybody, introduced my wife, introduced everybody. And I say introduced everybody, but my mom. And so I had to live with that for quite, but I apologized to her more times than I care to mention, but, and she was okay with it, but I was a little sad because, you know, love your mother dearly. So.
That's right. What's, of course, you were in a new situation and
yes.
those things are bound to happen. Let's see.
They have projected that Galron will beat Thomas Massie.
Okay. Now yes. That's this. We talked about this earlier tonight. How big would Trump's endorsement be
yes.
in the races? And if this is the case, then that would mean that Trump's endorsement had some impact. Right? Well, at least he picked the winner. I mean, it was, right.
Everyone that he picked, it looks like, is going to win. You've got Andy Barr. He endorsed him. You've got, looks like Ralph Alvarado is probably going to win the 6th Congressional District. Thomas Massie looks like they projected that he is going to lose anyway. Obviously, the other ones that he endorsed, they were obviously probably going to win as incumbents and strong in their district. So they were going to win anyway. But in the three major ones that we looked at, he had a clean sweep. 3-0.
Clean sweep in the major ones, but then also the secondary where there weren't real challengers or as serious challenges in the first district of Jamie Comer.
He or the second.
And then the Hal Rogers in the fifth district.
And the Brett Guthrie in the second. So, yeah.
So
you could say he was 6-0 if you want to go with all of them.
So that's interesting. Thomas Massie, one of the few Republicans that really has taken a strong stand against the president. It looks like he is going to be exiting.
Yes. Well, if you listen to Thomas, he will tell you that he voted with the president 92% of the time. But apparently that 8% was problematic. So
I did moderate that forum. And one of the things I did, Mike, and you're aware of this.
Yeah.
But for the sake of those tuned in, I had looked at some of the attack ads that went out against Thomas, and they've been out for months and months, going back to last year, really. After Thomas Massie voted against the One Big Beautiful Bill in July, within a month, there were negative ads coming out and charging him with all kinds of different things. And I read those charges to him, and I said, can you respond to this? And this and this. And he did unpack that. One of the things he said is that that when you have a big bill that has a lot of bad stuff, often they'll put a few good things in there to sweeten the deal and make it more palatable for sitting congressmen to vote for it. And he couldn't do that. So he was accused of being for boys on the girls sports teams. That was part of this ad. For not fully sealing the border. That was another charge. Now, on both of those issues individually, he is on the conservative side. But provisions of that happened to be, at least in one version of the bill, and he couldn't vote for it. And that's something I think that is frustrating for a lot of congressmen, where there are important issues, and then there are bad bills or bad issues, and they get mixed together in order to kind of get the ball across the line. It makes it tough to be in Congress.
It is tough to be in Congress.
So, and that might be why Congress has such a low approval rating. Gallup came out with a survey or a poll back in April. 86% of Americans disapprove of the job that Congress is doing. It ties an all-time low for disapproval of Congress. Right. So this is one reason.
Well, and the big question we'll have to ask is, well, a couple. One, when in the fall?
Now, it is the 4th. Now, that's a very conservative district.
It is, but, you know.
When was the last time, last time a Democrat held that seat?
It's probably 15 or 20 years ago.
To think Jeff Young held it, but then I think it.
There was like a Jeff, because we've talked about, I think there was a Jeff Davis that was, no, well, he was a Republican, but there was, right before him, there was a Democrat.
Or is it Jeff? I'm confusing the names. It's late. But
yes.
But there was a Democrat that held it.
There was a Democrat that held it for a couple of years. And he held it for, if I remember correctly, he held it for a few terms and then didn't run again.
It's considered mostly a Republican district.
Yeah.
So, but this is a midterm, Mike, and let's talk about this for a minute, where the Republican approval rating is low, and the president's approval rating is low. So the primaries are one thing, to endorse in the primary and then to have the president's guy emerge from that. But there's a whole different scenario when it comes to the midterm. Traditionally, the party that has control of the White House, they lose seats in Congress. And now one of the dynamics here is that there have been redistricting efforts at the state level. Texas is one. Want to see Tennessee. There's several other states that are redistricting. California, I mean, they're doing it in favor of their respective parties. California is making it more blue for their congressional districts. Texas and Tennessee, they're making it more red for the Republican Congress congressional districts. Right. What do you see happening in the midterm general election
for here or for
across the country?
You know, it's hard to know for sure, because let's just say everything was equal. Typically, historically, the president that is in power loses quite a few House seats and to a certain degree a small number of Senate seats in the midterms.
Yeah.
But if you do some midterm redistricting to add, you know, 10 or 12 leaning Republican seats, you could have a wash. The Republicans could hold on to the House depending on how the redistricting.
Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it looks like Thomas Massie is giving a concession speech right now. So he's up there with his wife, and he is thanking his supporters for standing with him. So Thomas Massie, who has been in office since 2012, a seven-term congressman, has lost the 4th district congressional seat. Of course, Donald Trump was very involved with that. $35 million spent in that race, a record amount of spending. And he, Thomas Massie, is conceding in that race.
Yeah.
So we were, before I cut you off, we were talking about the results of the midterms and what might happen with the Republicans nationally.
Yeah, it's really hard to know. Part of it will really depend on how quickly Trump can resolve the situation in Iran, the war in Iran. If gas is $4 a gallon come the fall, then more likely the Democrats will win the House and maybe the Senate. If the economy can be stabilized, they can finish up the Iran war, and gasoline drops back down to $2 a gallon, it should be pretty good.
Yeah. Often pocketbook issues impacts at the national level. If the economy is tanking, if, as you said, gas is high, if interest rates are high, whoever's in office, people have the mentality, throw the bums out.
Right.
Let's get somebody else in there. And rightly or, you know, fairly or unfairly, that often is the case. And so we'll see. And that does happen at the state level, too.
It does.
We have these waves. We got a red wave. We got blue waves. And voter sentiment can sway based on often the bread and butter issues, if you will, pocketbook issues. And Republicans we'll see. As you said, Republicans could weather the storm if the gas prices go down and if the economy goes in a better direction, or there could be some pain for the Republican Party. Mike, if Democrats win Congress, what would that look like?
Yeah, you know, things could change, but if they won Congress, feel that it would be difficult, just the dynamics for them to win the Senate, but they could win the Senate, but it's unlikely. But you could see the Senate drop down to 51-49 type situation. The impeachment hearings will begin immediately.
Well, that's what I was getting to, because you've got a number of Democrats who've campaigned on that, and they're saying they're going to impeach Trump. They've run on that as candidates.
Why not do third and fourth and fifth generation?
Yeah, but of course, in order for the impeachment to be successful, you've got to have the Senate convict, and you need
67
in the Senate to convict.
Yeah.
Very good.
It's technically 66 and two thirds, but, you know, that third of a guy can't very well. I think that's right. Anyway, I may be wrong on that, but it's 67, I believe. So.
Yeah, very good.
Our population is roughly 4.5 million, so an ideal district would be
roughly 120. Those are the numbers that I'm familiar with.
Yeah.
I think it's ballpark figure, correct? The reason I bring that up is because 7,500 people turned out to vote in that Republican primary, and essentially it's a ballpark of 120,000 people. So small number of people who've determined who their next state senator is. We talked about voter turnout tonight. It was projected to be about 20%, and perhaps this is in line with that turnout.
Going back to your other analysis, the other thing we have to consider is now about 10% of your registered voters are independent, and they can't vote in either the Republican or the Democrat primary.
That's a good point.
So you wouldn't see them in the voting tabulations in a solely Republican, because you wouldn't have the Democrats registered voters and you wouldn't have the independents.
So are you in favor of an open primary?
No. I mean, there was a time that I thought that maybe if there was only a primary in one party or the other, but not a race in the fall, I might be open to allowing independents. But I just think that the parties need to decide who their nominee is going to be. So, and letting independents vote in one or the other, now you could have a situation where, I remember when Rush Limbaugh was alive, and when it looked like Obama was going to win, they had Operation Chaos, where he tried to convince all the Republicans to go in and vote for Hillary Clinton, get in the open primary states, go vote for Hillary Clinton, just to create additional chaos. I don't know if you remember that, but it was...
I forgot about that.
Yeah, so...
Well, and that didn't work. It worked out for...
Obama still won.
Obama still won. So it didn't really work out. There wasn't as much chaos as was called for. So...
But he wasn't really a big fan of Hillary either. He was just trying to cause...
We talked about our candidate training earlier in the program, but this is one of the things that the Commonwealth Policy Center does, is to help candidates understand what it takes to win an election, to run a credible campaign, all the way from your filing requirements to putting together a campaign team, fundraising, messaging, get out the vote. Mike, you added a lot to that, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you.
You brought a lot of experience and...
Hopefully a little humor.
And a little humor.
I always got a little humor.
Can't forget that.
Yes.
But we did 7 of those trainings in about, a 5-month time period. I want to say from September to the end of February.
And we did various ones. Early on, we did like 4-hour trainings. And then we had a couple of some of the parties wanted us to do a distilled down version. So we got it down to about 2 hours. And I think they got a lot out of the 2 hours. I had a lot of good comments from that. So.
And we do plan to do more.
Yeah.
But not this year. But we will do more in the future.
Oh, well, it's so good for have the resource, because, you know, when I first started running in 1998, there was very little resources. I mean, I felt like I was wandering in the desert.
You were learning by trial and error, right?
Yes. Well, it was kind of like Tom Buford. I always used to laugh. Of course, he's passed on, but Senator Tom Buford, when he was around, he always used to joke early on, especially early on when I was first starting. He always used to say, I'm not a member of an organized party. I'm a Republican.
And, now, that meant something when you said it, because Republicans were in disarray.
Yes.
They were in the minority. Even when he started in the Senate, I think they're in the minority.
Well, when he started the Senate, they were a minority.
So it looks like we're going to have to do the final recap tomorrow, Mike.
There you go.
So why don't we'll sign off. This has been really good to be with you and to do the returns and to do a little analysis.
Yes.
And then to talk about CPC's election resources that we provided. Mm-hmm. Thank you all for joining us. If you're not signed up to receive our email updates, please go to our website, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and sign up to get our regular updates, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and we will keep in the loop, especially as we go through the summer and up into the fall election season. We will have more resources, even more than we had for the primaries. So again, sign up there, commonwealthpolicycenter.org, and we will keep you in the loop there. Thanks for joining us this evening. God bless you, and have a good rest of your evening.
Happy radio. Thank you.